Welcome back to ZJM's Diversity Pod, and we are here another week talking about another EDI issue, and we are talking equality, diversity and inclusion. This week we are taking it a little bit differently, as we do, don't we always? I think that's one of my commonly used phrases, always taking it different. I mean, there's always a hot topic going around there anyway, but we are touching upon a term that may be slightly academic, but is very relevant when discussing racism, discussing culture, the politics of belonging and identity. Before we actually go into discussing what the actual topic is, I want to repeat a very specific quote that I found by Rob Tell Paley. And that is, "The white gaze of development is measuring black, brown, and non-white people against the standard of northern whiteness, and taking their political, economic, and social processes as a norm. Development that uses the standard of northern whiteness to measure economic, political, and social processes of people in the so-called global south." This is a very academic quote, and I will be breaking it down because it's very complicated, it's based in research, it's based in social policy, which is my specialism, so to speak. But this week, we are talking about the white gaze. The white gaze is a very problematic concept. The action itself of the white gaze is problematic, but the discussions on white gaze are now relevant more than ever. Discussions of the white gaze are typically seen within academia, research, and actually now people are realizing that they are actually quite present within corporate environments. The white gaze can result in a myriad of outcomes, consequences, social, economic, political, and personal circumstances that can be very damaging, very negative for a person's sense of identity, belonging, and actually fiscal welfare. So this article is going to discuss why we need to talk about decolonization and the broadening of perspectives, why that is something that is so important. We need to discuss what exactly is wrong with the white gaze and how it can affect decision-making within the world of recruitment and in the corporate environment. Because while the white gaze is very specifically related to academia and research and educational studies all in all, it wouldn't really be beneficial for me to talk about that if I couldn't relate it to the importance of knowing how it impacts the corporate environment and the corporate space, how employees are made to be, how they are made to feel, how they are made to behave. And sometimes it can range from things that are so unconsciously ingrained and conditioned into society that we don't even realize that it may be a problem for someone. Let's go into a little bit more detail. What is the white gaze? I'm going to break down that quote that was above just because I think that quote is incredibly useful in helping us understand the impact of white gaze, the different sectors of society that it can affect. That quote is a little bit complicated. So, let's simplify it. White gaze is looking at everyone, specifically non-white individuals, through a Western or Eurocentric lens of being white. When I say the word Eurocentric, it specifically focuses on Western Europe or Western European ideologies. If you're thinking about what countries might be included in this, think United Kingdom, France, Germany, Sweden, Italy. Well, Italy is more Southern Europe, but that general area. And there are many, many more. Don't forget Spain and Portugal are also in there as well. These ideologies, which are considered Eurocentric, have been alive and kicking for centuries, and they are what have been applied to cultures and customs the way people should be behaving. So the white gaze, it assumes that these white Western political, social and economic ideas are dominant. They are mainstream, not just in their own countries and according to their own race, but absolutely everywhere in the entire world. So the idea here is that the white lens and the white Eurocentric lens doesn't shift, it doesn't move away. That's the only lens that they see the world through. Now, under the guise of white gaze, it is the standard for processing people and how you understand people. You relate and talk to people in a way that suits you, your ideas, and your ideologies. And this doesn't take place at workplace levels. It's community, regional, subnational, national, and now transnational and international levels. Recently, more and more research has been picking up on the fact that Eurocentric ideals and ideas have been placed on communities and nations that are outside of the bounds of Western Europe. I have seen it applied to my own home country and culture in Pakistan. And it's astounding to see the effect that it can have on individuals and the outcomes of their mannerisms, their education, and their workplace and employment practice and behaviours. I want to give some examples, and they are specifically going to be focused on the workplace to help employers understand what some either subtle or very obvious examples or practices or policies in the workplace look like under the guise of white recruitment. Number one, assuming a specific standard for what professional looks like in a workplace. This can range from believing in certain headdresses and hairstyles such as braids or afros being unprofessional and unacceptable styles in the workplace. I want you to do something now as you are listening. Close your eyes or keep your eyes open, but I want you to imagine in your head when I say the word professional workwear, what the first items of clothing are that come into your head. For many, especially within Europe and the United States, and actually now across many countries in the globe, it is a suit. A blazer, a tie, a collared shirt, tailored trousers, loafers or smart shoes. And this isn't just for men. Sans the tie, almost in every way, this applies to women too. I'm not going to give the alternative non-white gaze perspective yet. I'm going to do that collectively after a little bit of soul searching and a little bit of thinking. Right now, I'm just going to continue on posing some thoughts and perspectives that will make you think about the white gaze. Number two, not giving time off for staff who have daily requirements of faith. This can be not giving breaks for individuals who may have to perform daily prayers. And this can take place in many, many different religions. Number three, applying ideals, ideas and sources, or bringing in experts from Western research or Western companies that have been developed and for countries that are Eastern or are considered non-Eurocentric. Number four, not understanding the intersectional and racial difficulty of disregarding the colonial history of individuals who are not white. This can be displayed or demonstrated through saying, I observe colorblindness, or I don't see race and I don't see color. In many cases, this is a disregard for specific individuals' difficulties because when you are not white, in many cases, individuals have had to overcome many hardships and sufferings to get to the positions that they are. Whether it's on a very large institutional scale or whether it's at a community level. And by many white individuals saying that they don't see colour or race in an attempt to be more universal and supposedly unbiased, it can be naively ignorant of the different histories that people have gone through to get them to the point to where they are today, and how people of colour identify with themselves and with their races. Further along, as I go through this pod, I will reframe some of these situations and demonstrate how we can alleviate white gaze and what it might look like when the white gaze is not present. Of course, everything that I say here is my perspective. Where I use sources, I cite. But I just want to frame from what I think white gaze may... What are some of the effects of white gaze? Some individuals feel like they may have to utilize extra resources, time, money, and energy to become a part of society at the expense of whiteness. Individuals and employees who work under the scrutiny of white gaze have to demonstrate behaviors and succumb or conform to beauty standards of whiteness as well. Taking the examples of braids and afros in certain institutions where it is unjustly considered unprofessional, many have to spend a lot more time and resources to get their hair to a standard where it is considered professional in order for them to work and make money. Whiteness and values and behaviours have standard images that are considered superior and dominant, and it is a presumed assumption that this is the right way to live. Under the white gaze, whiteness and what it represents is simultaneously considered dominant over any culture or practice that is not synonymous with whiteness, and it is also the determining factor of how people are meant to live their lives, especially within corporate environments. In some workplaces, this can lead to certain individuals or groups of people in an organization or company to become hypervisible. And this is for not aligning themselves to ideologies that are linked to the white gaze. In other cases, in more severe cases, this can lead to suspensions, terminations, and verbal abuse within the workplace. Let's relook at some of the scenarios. What would it be like if we omitted the white gaze from influencing others' behaviours, actions, and speech? So, number one, we addressed physical appearance and beauty standards and what it is like in a workplace. So, globally, many cultures have different ideas about what is considered professional. In Eurocentric ideologies, the suit has become the universal image of what it is like to look professional. Yet, this is not the case in many different nations and can actually make many feel insecure or uncomfortable. There are also relations with this to hairstyles and headdresses. When it comes to braids, cornrows, afros, hijabs, many of these things are a part of someone's identity and is a part of some long-standing history. When you are asking someone to give up that part of themselves in order for them to have a career, in order for them to pay to have a life, you are saying that their sense of being or belonging is a lot less important than them conforming to standards of an employment contract. Assuming that these styles are not professional is a blatant disregard for different cultures, assuming that everyone should attain similar looks, and assume that professionalism means the same everywhere, and that everyone can easily attain similar looks of professionalism, such as straight hair, or without spending excessive money, time, and resources, without damaging your hair in the process. Many Eurocentric organizations do not recognize taking time off of faith, and this is number two. And the stipulation here is that it cuts into way too much time when individuals are working. Whilst to some degree I understand why this may be said, as an individual is contracted to be working, breaks are not even considered for this time period. And I think, especially when it is, when faith is a vital part of living, it is something that employees should be conscious of. There seems to be a trend here that anybody who is not part of secular, Eurocentric, white ideologies is made to fit a mold of what it's meant to be like when they want to integrate into that space. And in trying to fit into that mold, they lose many pieces of themselves. Some pieces that may not be recovered, or some pieces of themselves that may end up being damaged. Sometimes I feel like we have to question ourselves. Do we have to make ourselves fit into that mold in order to integrate? Is it worth it when it costs or damages so much? Something for you all to think about. Number three was more related to academia and research and general ideas and prospects within the workplace. And that was about implementing idea or ideals in a workplace, in a Western environment or in a Eurocentric secular environment that is not appropriately applied or relevant to so-called Eastern countries or countries that administer faith. Not all programs that are implemented in a workplace are suitable or culturally appropriate for members and employees. I personally think you need to have a well-trained diversity officer, not just the HR department who can handle this. You need to have individuals who understand how important intersectionality is. And if you do not know what intersectionality is, it is thinking about all the different avenues of how someone comes to be. There are different intersections that come to make up a human being. I am a woman. I am a brown woman. I am a brown Pakistani woman. I am a brown Pakistani woman who is a Muslim. All these intersections start to build and start to form and create a human being. And one element of that person cannot coexist without the other. They all make up that being, and a good diversity officer will help realize that all of those things interconnect to make the individual who they are and shapes the way they function and behave and speak. And of course, the list that I just simply stated about myself is nowhere near all the supposed intersections of my being. There are many, many more. I want you all to think about where you work and how much you feel like your identity is possibly compromised. And if it's not, how does your operation or organization function in a way where you feel like you do not have to compromise yourself? What are the avenues that you can take to recognize white gaze? Perspective is incredibly important. Many people need to realize that in order for you to understand the impact of white gaze, you need to see who it is impacting, understand their perspective, and make a change. Going the way we are going, assuming that whiteness is dominant, is suppressing a whole portion of society. We do not need our identities to become compromised because of the whiteness or white gaze. We have a habit, and this has become conditioned, internalized, and unconscious, to center whiteness in all of our behaviors, in all of our transactions, in all of the ways we function, whether it has something to do with employment, social care, fiscal welfare, cultural habits. It is time to understand the importance of a more intersectional and decolonized approach. Okay, So we're ending this podcast on a lot more of a serious note this week, just because I think that this is a subject matter that is so grave. And often the term white gaze is relegated to a specific stream of academia within social sciences and policy that many people don't have the chance to realise the impact that it could possibly have on people. So I want to leave you all with the thought here. We've spent our time here talking about what the white gaze is. Have you ever encountered it as a person of colour, or are you conscious of how it can affect other people? How do you remain mindful of how your possible dominant white gaze can affect others? Is there something that you are doing to rebut it or challenge it or change perspectives? And on the matter of perspectives, are you going around trying to change perspectives, listen to different perspectives? Because sometimes being an active listener in a situation does a lot more than doing all of the talking. Well, considering I'm the one who's done all the talking today, I'm going to stop and I want to reflect. So, we're going to end it here. Thank you for listening to DJM's Diversity Pod. I would love to hear all of your thoughts on everything that has been discussed today. I think it is a very important subject matter that needs to be brought to more light, because we are not a post-racial society. Race is prevalent and it needs to be discussed. So, like, share, comment, drop me a DM on Instagram to let me know what you thought. It's been Noor, and it's been good. I will see you all next week.